Well, the court's ready to resume the call of the day, and the second case that we have before us today is number 063779, Insight against the Spam House Project. Mr. Martin?
May it please the court, my name is Craig Martin from Jenner & Block. We represent the Spam House Project pro bono as part of our pro bono program. The Spam House Project is a United Kingdom not-for-profit organization whose mission is essentially to ferret out spam on the Internet. This appeal is about the district court's entry of a default judgment against Spam House. The main issue, well, let me back up and tell you, this appeal has a lot of issues in it. The main issues on appeal that we are going to present and focus on in this argument are, first, whether the district court erred in entering default judgment without first finding that there was personal jurisdiction and satisfying itself that service of process was adequate. The second issue that we are going to focus on in this argument is whether the district court erred in issuing a permanent injunction that both restrained and compelled speech without conducting the traditional rule review under the four factors of Rule 65 and without making findings of fact.
Now, with respect to that first issue, Mr. Martin, I think there's a threshold question that I'd like your view on. What authority do you rely on for the proposition that the district court had an obligation to address the issue of personal jurisdiction in the context of deciding whether to enter a default judgment?
To be clear with the court, we have no Seventh Circuit case that suggests that there is an affirmative duty for a district court to look into personal jurisdiction prior to the entry of a default judgment. So I want to be crystal clear about that. And what we are doing is asking the court to fashion a rule in this case that when a district court has a foreign, not-for-profit, Internet-based defendant, that an inquiry into personal jurisdiction is appropriate. It's a unique circumstance in this case. There are three cases from other circuits that we have cited in our brief that we rely upon by analogy, if you will. The first case comes out of the Tenth Circuit, and that's where the law seems to be the most clear with regard to an affirmative duty to look into personal jurisdiction prior to entering default against a non-appearing defendant. And that case is the Garberg and Associates case versus Pack Technical at 115 F3rd 767.
What in that case makes it similar to this one?
The facts in that case involve a Kansas company suing a Canadian, a foreign Canadian company, in what appears to be a commercial transaction. In that case, the court fashions a rule that there is an affirmative duty to look into personal jurisdiction. That case has a very confused set of facts in which the plaintiff goes in, gets a TRO. The TRO is then served upon the Canadian company. The Canadian company, prior to the entry of the TRO, had sent a letter to the judge saying that they contested personal jurisdiction, a letter from Canada, from Canadian counsel to the judge. The Canadian company then enters an appearance asking for personal jurisdiction to be ruled upon, and the court drags out the proceeding and never rules upon personal jurisdiction. The court fashions a rule that there's an affirmative duty to look into personal jurisdiction. That rule is then picked up by two other circuits. One is the, and these cases are in our brief, but one is the Fifth Circuit, and the other is the Ninth Circuit. And the facts in the Fifth Circuit case involve what appears to be a freighter that arrives in the port of Houston and is getting sued by a plaintiff with regard to its activities when it arrives in the port of Houston. And the court cites the Tenth Circuit's rule that there's an affirmative duty to look into personal jurisdiction. This case, and then there's a Ninth Circuit case that is somewhat similar.
The duty you want to have is when foreign entities are involved as defendants.
Yes. And to be specific, in this case, there's evidence in the record, and there's that suggest that this is a not-for-profit, internet-based company in the United Kingdom. This record is fairly confused and confusing. Studied a lot in the last couple of days, but it's a fairly confused and confusing record. And when the district court, with regard to a foreign internet-based not-for-profit that is essentially an affiliation of volunteers fighting spam on the internet, has facts before it that suggest that there may not be personal jurisdiction, and the only indication of personal jurisdiction that it has is conclusory boilerplate allegations in a complaint. That's not sufficient to establish personal jurisdiction. And I think there's sound policy reasons to adopt such a rule in this case. It's easier to speak to it from the consequences of what happens when you don't look into personal jurisdiction before proceeding in a case like this. In a case like this, what the consequence of proceeding is that a default judgment is entered, and then all kinds of discovery starts to take place in the district court with regard to the default judgment that involves both domestic and international companies. The burden on the not-for-profit entity is substantial with regard to its presence or non-presence in the U.S. The better way to approach a case like this that involves the internet is novel enough, spam is novel enough on the internet. The better way to approach a case like this when the district court knows that there's issues about personal jurisdiction would have been to start ascertaining some facts about why personal jurisdiction exists or doesn't exist.
On the other hand, Mr. Martin, if we're taking a look here at fashioning a fairly specific rule, we do have another aspect of the case we'd have to take into consideration. An answer was filed here. It was withdrawn. The case does have a certain aroma of your client having gamed the system a bit, too.
I think that aroma is the reason that the Honorable Judge Koukouras did what he did. But let me explain specifically what happened, okay? With regard to the district court, E360 went to state court and got a TRO. Okay, that the case, the not-for-profit in England gets hold of the original complaint not because it's served upon them. There's no evidence that it's ever served upon them. They just find out about it. They remove the case to federal court, and that same day file in their removal petition and in their answer, they object all over the place to personal jurisdiction, and they object all over the place to whether service of process is proper. Then, essentially, they have some issue that's not in the record with regard to their retained lawyers. And their retained lawyers show up before Judge Koukouras a few weeks later and say that they're there to do two things. One is to withdraw their appearance, and two is to withdraw the answer. They don't say anything. They don't say anything else that's meaningful, and they don't say what they're allowed to do or what they're not allowed to do.
But didn't the judge then, is this the lawyers from Hinshaw, was it?
Yes, it is.
Didn't the judge then tell the lawyers that this means, in effect, that a default judgment is going to be entered against your client? And do they know that? And apparently the answer was affirmative, that they knew that.
I don't think the record will say whatever it says on this, but I believe that the record would reveal that the lawyers for Hinshaw did not say yes, and the judge told them that after this day they should go tell Spam House that they're going to be defaulted. Also on the record that day, they asked the court to withdraw the answer, and the court lets them withdraw the answer. E360 doesn't object to them withdrawing the answer, and we've researched that issue high and low, and as best we can tell, and we've cited three cases in our brief to this effect, that essentially puts Spam House in the position of a traditional defaulting party that has never answered in the first place.
Which did they do first, withdraw their appearance or withdraw the answer?
I think the order comes out that day, and I think it has both things in it. So I don't know that I would. I don't know that I could slice it that thin.
Whether they had authority to withdraw the answer, was there any indication that they didn't have authority to withdraw the answer?
There's no indication on the record one way or the other. But what I'm suggesting is if the district court, if you wanted to make much ado about the fact that they answered or appeared in the United States through counsel and answered, the district court didn't have to let them withdraw their answer. The district court could have held them in the case. The other side could have objected and say, look, you answered, you're here on personal jurisdiction grounds. Instead, they didn't object. The district court let them, you know, unring the bell, if you will, and they were put back into the position.
Wouldn't it to object, you're the plaintiff in a lawsuit, to object to the other side withdrawing their answer. I don't imagine that you'd ever would want to. In that situation.
We may be too aggressive, but I don't think it would be odd in the circumstance to object to them withdrawing the answer if you wanted to take the position that by virtue of them filing the answer that they had somehow waived personal jurisdiction objections.
Well, they had personal jurisdiction objections all over the place, so that was part of their answer, wasn't it?
That's part of our position.
But, well, no, they objected right away, didn't they?
No, yes, Spam House objected in both its removal petition and the answer. They've always objected to personal jurisdiction. The other side takes the position that we've waived personal jurisdiction by removing the case, by answering the case, and then they also cite the a case from the Seventh Circuit that holds that a party defendant waives by not raising personal jurisdiction in a Rule 60B motion, which is not the case here.
Fair, though, to say that Insight was on notice, that unless they objected at that point, there was still the possibility that the district court was going to go into the question of personal jurisdiction? Were they really on notice that they had to object at that point? I mean, you're asking us to fashion a rule to that effect now in this case on appeal, but well, from their perspective, in that courtroom on that day, why would they have felt they needed to object and needed to have this question of personal jurisdiction nailed down?
I think that's fair. I just don't think they can have their cake and eat it too. I don't think that they can say withdraw the answer and then say, look, because you answered, you've waived your objections to personal jurisdiction. I don't think that that makes sense. But to be clear, the district court could have, and in our view, should have made an inquiry into the facts underlying personal jurisdiction, because the facts before the district court at that time are that there is an internet-based not-for-profit out of London that calls somebody a spammer. And the only allegations in the complaint are boilerplate allegations about doing business in Illinois, and the same allegations you see in every complaint that's filed everywhere in the country. They're the same boilerplate allegations about personal jurisdiction, but there is no factual record whatsoever that is developed with regard to real personal jurisdiction. There's no factual record with regard to how our clients, Spam House's website, behaves. There's developing case law about internet personal jurisdiction that suggests that if you have simply a passive website versus an active website, that there are different connotations for personal jurisdiction. And we cite in our brief one of the cases that we think is, you know, lays out the law pretty well, which is the Zippo case, which talks about a continuing spectrum. But there is, when you go through the traditional minimum contacts analysis and apply it to the internet, or and especially a not-for-profit anti-spam organization over in London, there's no factual basis here to assert personal jurisdiction over them. And the downsides to doing it are rather, the downsides to not looking into personal jurisdiction in this case are rather severe with regard to
from the allegation, their allegation is that your client intended and did take action to harm a company in the state of Illinois.
They plead those types of allegations. They plead tortious interference and allegations like that. But What they factually plead is that our client essentially listed them as a spammer on its website. And our client lists, I think it's 200 other organizations as spammers on their website. Our client doesn't do anything else, so there's no purposeful. It's not like our client sits in London and shoots something directly to Illinois. There's no purposeful availment of the laws of Illinois. Our client puts something on its website out in London, and then anyone in the world can pick it up. So E360 could be, you know, and I don't know how many affiliates or other companies they may have, but they could be sitting here in Illinois. They could be sitting in Cancun. They could be in the Cayman Islands. They could be in Timbuktu. That doesn't mean that there should be personal jurisdiction just because our company put something on a website in London.
Is there any interactive aspect to this posting?
I'm sorry, I missed the first
one. Is there any interactive aspect to the post?
There's no record evidence with regard to interactive aspects to the posting, if you will. And my understanding, and you know, look, you can go to the website yourself, right? And I've been to the website. My understanding is that this website would fall closer to the passive type of website that this court would not have jurisdiction over than to an active type of website that this court would have. But that's exactly the kind of evidence that we'd like to go back to the district court to develop, is evidence with regard to active and passive. If I may, because I reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal, but I want to hit on one other issue that I think is really significant to this appeal, and that is the way the court fashioned their permanent injunction. The permanent injunction, and I just want to direct you to it, the permanent injunction itself is, in our view, vague and unworkable on its terms. It talks about...
Mr. Martin, if I may interrupt, the court is conferred, and we're going to give each of you 5 more minutes. So you can add that to your time. We've asked you a lot of questions. We know you want to get to the second issue, and counsel for the appellee, you ought to have time to respond to that, too. So we've just added 5 minutes to your time.
Well, thank you.
We're going to take 5 minutes away from one of the next cases.
Well, one of my partners is arguing in a minute. You can use his time. With regard to this, let me jump to the second argument. It's the injunction argument, and with regard to the injunction, our basic position is the district court enters a permanent injunction, and this injunction is wreaking havoc on Spam House. The permanent injunction has first of all, the district court does not go through the traditional four-part analysis under Rule 65. The record is completely devoid. E360 throws into the supplemental appendix the state court record to sort of bootstrap that in, but that's not before the district court. So we don't have a district court that goes through carefully the four parts of Rule 65 and makes findings of fact and conclusions of law before entering a very broad prospective permanent injunction that both compels and restricts speech. And on that basis alone, the injunction should be vacated. And I'll tell you, I think you hit on why the district court did that. One of you said that, you know, come on, you came in and you withdrew the answer and it seems kind of funny. Well, it did seem sort of funny, and the district court at that very moment decided he was going to enter default, and then within a few weeks he does this permanent injunction that's very broad.
That was essentially the TRO that had been entered in state court, though, wasn't it?
Had he had the TRO that had been entered in state court and had the same record before him, I think we would argue against that as well. But this was not even before him. And he fashioned his own injunction. He didn't line up exactly to the TRO. So he came up with his own injunction based on their default. The second point with regard to this injunction is that it is very vague with regard to who plaintiffs are, who their affiliates are, their subsidiaries, their related companies, and who is controlled by plaintiffs. So that it's when Spam House goes to do something, they don't know specifically who it is that's getting something done. It also has has language in there that prohibits any action by Spam House that could interfere with their sending of emails. Well, Spam House basically lists spamming companies on its website. That's all it does. It engages in that aspect of free speech. That may be used by anyone in the world to do whatever they want with. So it's very difficult to tell what this injunction means and how to enforce it. The second point that I want to make with regard to that is that it is a prior restraint, and it is a classic prior restraint. The main position taken by the appellees is that this involves conduct as opposed to speech. But this clearly involves speech. This involves essentially a Spam House identifying someone as a spammer and saying that they are a spammer in their own house, if you will, putting it up on the internet in their own house. Anyone who wants to go to their website can go listen to it from anywhere in the world. But it's not Spam House engaging in some particular type of conduct. They cite the Rumsfeld case from the Supreme Court that involves college campus recruiting and whether the military can come on college campuses. Well, that is conduct. But what you say about the military coming on college campuses and what you post on your website about them coming on college campuses, that is speech. So we think that this is a prior restraint. The third point that I want to make is that this is truly compelled speech. If you look at the injunction requires that Spam House essentially put a retraction on their website saying, whoops, we erroneously listed E360 as a spammer and they are not a spammer.
The National Labor Relations Board does that all the time, though, don't they?
With regard to commercial speech, there's a difference between, I think, commercial speech and non-commercial speech. In commercial speech,
post a sign that says you violated the National Labor Relations Act. Is that commercial speech?
I think it's sui generis to the National Labor Relations Board. This is speech where you have to put a label on, your website saying that they're not a spammer. And that is opinion speech as opposed to anything else is our position with regard to that.
It was a bit more explanatory and said that the United States District Court for the Northern District of Illinois has entered a default judgment against us in a case where this was the allegation. Would that be all right?
With which we
simply report the court's holding.
I think that would be... I would think that would be fatal because it would be compelling them to speak, and it would be, if the United States District Court wanted to put that on their own website, that would be the place that it should be, as opposed to forcing Spam House to put it on their website and talk about some act that happened in the United States. So I don't think that that would be appropriate. I think that the permanent injunction also requires a 1-inch by 1-inch label to be put on the website, and when you think about that, it's impossible to figure out how you would put a 1-inch by 1-inch label on a website. I look at emails and websites on my BlackBerry, and the screen is about this big, so putting a 1-inch by 1-inch label seems unworkable to us as well. Those are the main issues that we wanted to highlight during the oral argument, but principally, we'd like to go back to the district court and get a fair chance to contest personal jurisdiction here as opposed to having to do it 3 years later in London. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. We'll hear now from Mr. Lotham.
May it please the court. My name is Bart Lathan, and I'm pleased and honored to be before you today. I represent the plaintiff in this matter and the appellee, E360 Insight, and David Linhart. The rule appellant would ask you to fashion goes far beyond any rule that's been fashioned in any other circuit. They ask you to fashion a rule that requires the district court to do the job of the attorneys for a defendant. In this case, We received a TRO after providing evidence of jurisdiction and service in a state court manner. Upon receipt of that TRO, defendants answered the case, removed the case, answered the case, and filed their appearance. They appeared before the court. They had every opportunity to contest the jurisdiction and the service through motion practice, should they have desired to do so. They instead filed an answer and alleged or preserved or somehow think that they've kept their right to challenge that jurisdiction, but they never moved to do that despite the fact that they were in the case, they answered the case.
Now, let me ask you this. It's cutting through everything here. Why wouldn't it be an appropriate way to resolve this case to simply vacate the default judgment, send it back, and require the payment of costs, all the expenses, attorney's fees that your side has endured here? Because there are obviously issues that they want to resolve, and they had some falling out apparently with the Hinshaw and Culbertson firm, and that kind of got us into this situation that we're in right now.
The precedent that would set is staggering. It allows a whole new strategy.
I mean, there's oftentimes default judgments are entered, and then a couple of weeks later they're set aside and on terms.
But in this...
That puts you into a good position so that you wouldn't have spent a lot of time and money unnecessarily.
Well, we have spent a lot of time and money, but given the procedural history of this case, for them to take an affirmative act to take the case out of state court, to take an affirmative act to answer and appear, take an affirmative act to withdraw when they knew the consequences of that withdrawal opens up a whole new strategy for defendants to remove things, stall it out, and then go away.
But also, you got a $13 million award here and a far-reaching injunction without having to really do much to earn it.
They had every opportunity to contest that. Every opportunity to contest that at every step along the way. The precedent for this would just allow for the door to be open to having a district court do the work of attorneys for defendants, and two, having lawyers remove items from state court to district court only to disappear later and take more time, more money, more effort.
The district judge would not have had to necessarily agree with their position on personal jurisdiction to set this default aside.
I completely understand that, and it just seems that we established jurisdiction, we established service at the state court. To allow them to come and affirmatively remove it to district court and make us do it again is counterintuitive to me.
Establish it. Was there a hearing on the issue of personal jurisdiction in state court?
There was a requirement to establish the jurisdiction and service in order to be granted the TRO. Those issues were delivered to Honorable Judge Bronstein, and he ruled in making his TRO that the court had jurisdiction and had effective service.
That was an ex parte.
Right.
That's correct. That is correct.
Well, how do you think they should have contested jurisdiction in federal court?
I think they should have made a motion to dismiss the case for failing to have jurisdiction instead of answering the complaint. I think that's the traditional way it would have been handled. That's the way it should have been handled.
Is there any rule that says they have to do it that way as opposed to maintaining the objection and the answer?
No, but neither is there a rule that says that they can bring it anytime they wish. They've answered preserving this. They've appeared in the case. They're subject to the jurisdiction of the court by appearing in the case. That's the crux of Judge Koukouras' ruling. The questions that he asks, the orders that he enters, the things that he says to counsel for defendant make it clear that they're in the case.
Well, they have jurisdiction to determine jurisdiction.
They have jurisdiction at the very least to determine jurisdiction, but they've answered. They've answered and they've appeared, and they were the ones who affirmatively removed it. He told them what was going to happen. He told them. They stated, I'll quote from memory to the best I can, that they're aware of the risk and they're willing to, and it's a risk they're willing to take, is what counsel for defendant said before they withdrew.
Even the cases cited by your colleague, the Tenth Circuit case and the other cases, were they on notice that they would not be given an opportunity to challenge the personal jurisdiction after the default was entered?
The cases, I'm sorry, in this particular case?
Yes, or before the default was entered, I should say.
Before the default was entered, they had raised these issues. That counsel had raised these issues in their removal petition and in their answer. They were told what was going to happen. They were told they were going to be defaulted. They said they were aware of these risks.
Were they aware, was one of the risks that the district court would not look at the matter of personal jurisdiction before going forward and entering the default?
The judge did not state that affirmatively in the record or to them. However, they raised it. They withdrew it. They're well aware of the law. They're appearing in the case. They have a duty to...
See, I'm asking you, what is the law? In other words, if you were sitting there at counsel table, I don't know whether you were or not, and the other side says it wants to withdraw and wants to withdraw its answer, and the judge says, well, in that case, I'm going to enter a default. Are you on notice that the judge is about to undertake... sua sponte, an examination of personal jurisdiction before actually entering the default?
I don't think you are. I don't think there's any requirement that the judge do that.
What about the cases cited by your colleague?
In those cases, there was a complete... Those cases, the defendants never showed up. They never had counsel appear before the judge. They never filed any sort of responsive pleadings. They just were never there.
Now we get someplace. I mean, in this case, your view is different because they file the answer.
In my view, and Judge Kokoris's view,
they got his permission to withdraw the answer, which is the document by which they had put personal jurisdiction in play.
But it doesn't
Should that have made you folks sit up a little bit more and said, well, what's the implication of this? Are we all on the same page on this?
I don't think so, given the nature of... First of all, I don't think it would have been proper for me as counsel to plaintiff to protest their withdrawal of an answer when to get a default judgment, and they're in the case and able to file their motions with respect to jurisdictional issues. I do think that it changes things substantially that they show up.
To be heard on the matter of in personam jurisdiction before the judge ruled any further, couldn't you?
When the state court had already, it strikes me as we went through that at state court. They then answer the complaint and show up, and for me to have to do that again didn't strike me as something that was required. The district court doesn't have that duty when there's counsel in the case to sua sponte go into the jurisdictional issues.
I thought you had made your record.
We had made our record. So,
but your opponent says that the state court material wasn't before Judge Cooper.
There was a copy of the order, the TRO order. The date that they withdrew, there was a motion up for for a rule to show cause to compel the TRO to be followed and adhered to. There was a copy of the TRO itself attached to that motion. The finding was in front of Judge Kokoris, as was the four...
The finding of the bare-bones finding that court had jurisdiction.
That court had jurisdiction, that court had accepted jurisdiction and service, that court had engaged in the four-part test in entry of the injunctive relief. So that was before the court.
What's the basis of the finding that your client was damaged to the tune of $13 million?
They have a significant inventory, shall we say, of people who have opted to receive messages. When they can send those messages to each and every person on that list, they can figure out very accurately how many of them will respond and how much money they'll be paid by their customers in order to for those responses. Spam House, by including our clients on their list, and we'll get into that a little more in a minute, but by including them on their list, there's an automated function that causes them, just by being added to that list, to be blocked by roughly 86,000 Internet service providers so that their email can't get through to anybody with an email address at those Internet service providers. On a per-person basis, we can figure out exactly how much we're losing by not being able to send to those people.
See, it just seems like this number's just been pulled out of the sky here.
There's an affidavit, and then there's a method for computing it.
Sure, but how hard or how long would it take to convince a trier of fact in a contested proceeding what the damages are here? I mean, it's difficult to put your finger on the damages and what an appropriate amount should be if you have, in fact, been wronged. And you might have been wronged. Don't get me wrong here.
Again, for us, there's a list of some 45 million unique names, and there is a dollar per name that is established without very much difficulty, and was established in this case. It was referenced in the affidavit.
How much profit did your company make a year ago or 2 years ago?
Well, they've been on this list for a significant period of time.
Well, how much money did they make the year before they were put on this list?
I'd have to get back to you on that, but their overall revenue is in the neighborhood of $1 million or $2 million. But they are severely limited and have always been severely limited in their ability to send due to organizations such as Spam House. And again, the opening up of the ability to send is something that we can arrive at fairly readily. And we did arrive at it fairly readily. We've talked about the jurisdictional issues and the failure of defendant to press the jurisdictional issues. There is case law, Continental Bank, that states that raising jurisdiction in a pleading or an answer doesn't preserve that defense in perpetuity. I'll grant you that they were not in the case for a significant period of time, but during the period of time they were in the case, they abandoned the case and thus abandoned their right to bring this claim. The Rule 60 appeal is similar in nature to the other items we've discussed on jurisdiction. I don't think there's anything particularly novel there. As for the injunction and the scope of relief, as we stated, the complaint was before the court, the affidavit was before the court, and the order of the TRO finding the four-part test being met and jurisdiction and service being met were before the court prior to the granting and the language of the permanent injunction. The judge took the permanent injunction under advisement, took a day to review and consider, and then fashioned his ruling on the permanent injunction. As far as the constitutional issues on prior restraint, our position is that the conduct of defendant is what's caused the damage, not the speech. If they want to get on the rooftop and say that he's spamming, or if they want to put it on a different website to say that he's spamming, it's not nearly as harmful as putting it on these lists, which have this automated function that block his email from going to some 86,000 internet service providers. The conduct of the automated list is the damaging feature, and that's not speech. That's conduct. Again, they can say what they want to say, but they can't take conduct that blocks the mail. In the Rumsfeld case...
Would you explain, first of all, you have they post the list. Then what happens?
There's an automated function that is paid for in certain cases or just delivered in certain other cases to an internet service provider such as Yahoo or MSN or whoever. That automated function, as soon as they are added to the list, their mail is blocked to that internet service provider.
But that's activated by the service provider rather than...
There's no software residing on the internet service provider. It's all just the act of putting them on the list immediately means they're blocked, 86,000 places. So it's the choice to use that as a blocking technique may fall to the internet service provider, but the conduct of putting them on the list is not speech. It's conduct putting them.
You're saying they facilitate it, and then it's up to the internet service provider then to access it.
Well, it's automated. The internet.
But it becomes automated. You have to take the initial step to make it automated.
They sell it through affiliated companies. They sell it to the internet service providers on stationery that says the Spam House Project. It's sold by their action. So the compelled speech on the retraction. The 1-inch by 1-inch was meant to be for a standard size computer. Alternative discussion with respect to that is certainly subject to the actual language and an agreement being posted. It's not Appellee's position that an entire BlackBerry be blocked by their 1-inch by 1-inch message. The nature of the fact that this is a retraction, the nature of the fact that the statements and the complaint and affidavit are taken as true, the speech that they're seeking to have protected is at best false, is at best false speech and not worthy of the same protections as other types of speech. And again, retractions are done all the time. The Gertz and Barlow cases stand for that. For that prospect. In summary, where would we be if this was allowed? Would a district court be required to make a jurisdictional argument for inquiry for all defendants of default? They state they seek a very narrow rule, but then is that rule, by analogy, moved to other default judgments? Other default judgments where attorneys have been present on behalf of a defendant. It's absurd, in my opinion, to think about the new strategies for state court litigants to remove items and then vanish, to let them take their ball and go home, and then later on say, I want a do-over, as my little kids would say. Fortunately, it's not the law now. To attempt to stretch the cases to this extreme is to request, in my opinion, a perversion of the existing law. And that concludes my remarks. If you have any further questions.
If they would have objected to jurisdiction under 12B and not withdrawn that 12B motion, how would you have proceeded then?
I think we would have argued that I think the judge at that point would have had at least some duty to inquire into it a little bit more. But they didn't. There's at least additional notice. And as Judge Kukora said, there is nothing in the record that even remotely provides for him the fact that there wasn't personal or subject matter jurisdiction in the case. If there was something before him, it seems to me from the language that he used in the transcript and in the orders that he would have undertaken such a finding. It seemed to me that he started to on the August 23rd hearing. He started to ask about jurisdictional issues, at which time defendant's counsel cut him off and withdrew. And being that there was no other motion pending, he saw nothing in the record. He certainly didn't abuse his discretion to find that they had submitted themselves to the jurisdiction and to enter the default judgment and the monetary relief and the injunctive relief. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Latham. How much time does Mr. Martin have? Thank you. 1.5, correct?
Thank you.
What? With the extension?
I have four. I thought I had reserved 4 minutes, but I have 4 points which I can go through relatively quickly.
I think you used up some of your rebuttal.
I'm sorry, I wasn't aware of that.
When the white light goes on, you're in your rebuttal time.
All right.
And we reset the clock for you when
there was obvious confusion. So let's
I've got four very quick points.
Points, 4 minutes. How's that? Okay.
Sounds fair. The first point is to answer some of the questions on damages. I think it's $11 million worth of damages. There are two components that the district court found. One is based on lost profits, and that's about $2 million, and it's for breaching, I think, for supposedly having three contracts that were withdrawn as a result of the listing on the internet by Spam House. There's no other evidence. The contracts aren't in the record. How much money they made on the contracts aren't in the record. It's just there's these three contracts that went away, and that's $2 million. The other $9 million is in lost business opportunity for four or five companies, none of which I've heard of, and I'm sure you wouldn't have heard of. And it says nothing more about the lost opportunities than there's just simply lost opportunities. So with that record, that's what the district court made an award of $11-plus million in its default judgment. And we've suggested in our brief that the court should have made findings of fact and had a real hearing. Even if our client wasn't there, you have to make findings of fact and have a real hearing. That's $11 million worth of damages. The second point I want to make is
there was $2 million in litigation costs, too.
In the award, I believe it's $2 million in breach of contracts and then another $9 million in, but I don't have it in front of me.
I see $11,715,000 in compensatory damages and $1.971 million in litigation costs.
Okay.
Which is 13, roughly.
Oh, okay. With regard to that 1.9, there's no evidence of that in the record either. With regard to the equities, the default was entered on the hearing at which time they withdrew was August 23rd. September 13th, the default was entered. We came into the case a month later, filed the appeal. That was October 13th, and within 2 weeks while we were investigating the case, we filed our Rule 60 motion. This defendant, Spam House, has never had a full opportunity to present its personal jurisdiction defense. The types of questions that the court is asking about how this website operates, whether or not it's sold or not, that stuff's not in the record. There's no record evidence about that. This is the type of evidence that you would develop in a record if you wanted to make findings about personal jurisdiction.
Why was the answer withdrawn?
That's not in the record, but the reason the answer was withdrawn is because Spam House was under the impression that there would not be that they could contest personal jurisdiction at any time here or in England and didn't fully appreciate the consequences of a default. There was a miscommunication between Spam House and its lawyers with regard to what was going on.
Well, certainly the lawyers knew one would think.
And we only know one side of the story, but it is clear to us that they did not appreciate the full consequences of a default. The personal jurisdiction issue, if you look at their website, and it's not in the record, but if you look at their website, you can see what they think of whether or not there's personal jurisdiction in this case. They clearly do not understand how American personal jurisdiction works. In this case, just like in the Tenth Circuit case, we think the court should find that there's a duty to look into personal jurisdiction. It was obvious on the record that was before the district court, a not-for-profit international internet company fighting spam.
Spam House does have recourse, however, if we ruled against you on personal jurisdiction against their former attorney, right?
They could if they chose to go down that road, but not with, that's a hard road to go down. And, and just so that it's clear, this case, this is not about Indiana and Illinois and personal jurisdiction 10 miles away. This is over the lake.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Indeed, the court thanks both counsel for their very excellent oral arguments today. The case will be taken under advisement.